way too many cat pictures. We need some chicken, you know, TikToks. There probably is like a half a million already, but.
Well, I follow this Chinese chicken farmer who he's a free range farmer and he shoots these videos. I shoot similar, but he does better, where he'll have like 500 chickens following him. And he'll do like, you know, like Braveheart, Mel Gibson, or he'll do like, you know, he's preaching and all the chickens are like mesmerized. So to your point, chicken TikTok is there and it's remarkably entertaining.
It's time for the Access of Easy podcast.
Charles,
you don't scream fire in a theater and you don't say unapproved words on YouTube. Welcome one and all to the Axis of Easy Salon number 34 with Jesse Hirsch and Charles Hugh Smith, and I'm Mark Jeftovic, and the date is December 10th. What do you guys want to talk about today? Other than what we were just talking about, which we shall not say again.
I want to talk about agricultural robots. Charles?
Well, I want to talk a little bit about Mark's paper that he sent us, sort of a massive review of cryptocurrency as of this moment, and which mentioned some of the ideas that are near and dear to us, like the network state and community scripts or tokens. And of course, the take on the paper was not really parallel to our take, but it raised a lot of interesting topics. So that's an easy one for me. But agricultural robots, hey, they're already out there, and so are drones.
Charles is referring to the Messari Report, the Crypto Theses of 2021, written by 2-Bit Idiot, is how he goes by on Twitter. I think his actual name is Ryan Selkis. Been reading him for years. Very first-rate coverage on the crypto space. And for me, what I find myself stunned by is how the antitrust suit against Facebook is being discussed almost as fait accompli, and it's like, oh, Facebook is going to be broken up. I mean, I think there's a long way to go before that happens, and tangential to that, mentioned in the Messari report, I didn't even realize that Facebook's Libra had undergone a third incarnation. I remember Libra was sort of aborted because of massive nation state pushback, and then they tried to resurrect it as, I think,
it was never aborted.
Well, that's where I'm going, because then I remember writing an Axis of Easy weekly update that they had rebranded it as Novi or Novus or something like that, and now it's called Diem or DM or however you would pronounce it. So it's undergoing yet another rebranding. I don't know what the state of the art is or where they are in the actual planning or deployment. But I do find it interesting.
I could answer that if you're interested.
What's that?
I said I could answer that if you're interested, but continue.
I'll just finish my thought that I find it astonishing that Facebook may be the first to fall under the antitrust hammer in a meaningful way if it actually goes through.
Although I agree with you 100%. It is no fait accompli. And, you know, it's the typical example of the chattering classes getting ahead of themselves and thinking that just because the event was tweeted, that all of a sudden the event is over. When, as we know from AT&T, as we know from IBM, as we know from Microsoft, antitrust proceedings can take a decade. They can take a very long time. And even though I'm presently writing an article about 2021 as being the year of antitrust, I don't think this is going to be resolved anytime soon, but I think the symbolism of it is profound, and I think that's why everyone's all excited. But I think your point in bringing up their digital currency is equally on point, because, you know, we talk about the network state, we talk about the kind of cyberpunk reality, and that's where I think Facebook is playing chess while everyone else is playing checkers. And, you know, on the one hand, to quickly go to your point about where is Facebook's digital currency. Well, originally it was going to be a multi-currency stable coin that would take some of the major national currencies in the world, convert that into a Facebook sponsored digital currency that as a stable coin would sort of correlate to all their values. Where they've sort of compromised and where their intentions are, I believe in early 2021, is to put forward a stable coin based only on the US dollar. So it's a similar idea. They still have their consortium. There's less people in the consortium than there was previously, but Facebook is 100% behind this. And it'll be a US dollar-based stable coin based out of Switzerland, because that's where the legal jurisdiction allows for these sorts of things to happen. But to go back, Mark, to your point about the antitrust hasn't happened yet, a scenario that I will articulate, I am not condoning this or promoting this, I am just floating it as a possible future that meshes with our discussions, is that they will fail to break up Facebook. They will fail to enact antitrust actions, and their failed attempt to slay the dragon will leave the dragon stronger and emboldened, and armed with its own digital currency, will perhaps be less coy about being the network state that it is, and instead start taking on more and more of the trappings of the autonomous entity that we fear or suspect it may be. So I think you're spot on, Mark, for anticipating that this antitrust battle is not only not finished, but maybe far more contentious, far more difficult than people realize. And, you know, the line I used, and I'm not sure if I articulated it in which newsletter this week, but it was the idea that I'm struggling to articulate this because you guys have your own personal connections to it. So I will serve it up on a platter, allow you to take where you will. Blaming Russia for all of this, ironically, has become part of the antitrust argument. And the extent to which Russia has hacked or interfered with U.S. elections via social media is part of the discourse and language of antitrust action. So it makes me wonder, even though the Trump administration started the antitrust action against both Facebook and Google, like you have to give them credit, this is their play. But as the Biden administration takes this over, and the Biden administration already has close ties with Silicon Valley, you know, there's an easy conspiracy theory to be written here that it's going to become far more political than it needs to be, and far more polarized than it ought to be, in part because initially it's a bipartisan issue. Both Republicans and Democrats are both in favor of, you know, restraining and if not breaking up the digital monopolies. So I'm kind of both cynical and interested in how the Biden administration is going to totally drop the ball on this and screw it up. But with that said, who knows? I'm obviously in favor of antitrust action, so I'd love to see something happen.
Well, let me zoom back up to 30,000 feet and talk about the network state as described very briefly in the paper that Mark distributed to us. And I think it's that paper is sort of state of the art in the sense that I believe it reflects a consensus in a lot of ways, despite being, you know, authored by a handful of people or perhaps one individual. The network stake in described in those few paragraphs is more of a kind of a techno geek vision, which has been out there for quite some time, where there's stateless passports and maybe, you know, this network state of anarcho, you know, capitalists might buy some, you know, remote island and actually set up a physical stateless state or something. But our conception that we've discussed here in our, you know, 30 plus salons is more centered on a corporate based, you know, network state, i.e. these big tech monopolies or cartels, if you wish. And the fact that they are in many ways more powerful and more part of everyone's daily life than the nation state that the person is a citizen of, right? So there's that. So there's those two visions of the network state, or sort of roughly speaking. And then there's a third one that we talk about here, which is more like a community-based, decentralized network based on empowering real local communities and sharing capital, you know, social, intellectual, and financial. And to my point, I think, which I've drawn a lot from Jesse and Mark in sort of summarizing this, democratizing capital and data. And that's what's lacking from these other two visions of the network state.
It almost sounds to me, and I was coming up against this when I was coming up with titles for previous issues, we have to come up with a taxonomy or a term to differentiate between that corporate network state that Charles just described and the more decentralized community, empowered communities that we like to envision in our imaginings. Because, I mean, there's no doubt about it, and I've said this numerous times, I'll recap it, or I'll say it again now, just for the record. Once Facebook, or someone like Facebook that has the same reach in the world, has their own currency, your Facebook account will be more relevant to your day-to-day life for a lot of people than your passport will be, especially in this era of post-coronavirus with probably secularly curtailed international travel.
I hate to also say the same thing I always say, but you know, in America, that's true already.
Yeah.
Those passports mean nothing to most Americans, right?
Right. Well, yeah.
Most Americans don't have a passport.
Yeah. There's a lot of unbanked in America, too. And, you know, Facebook can. And so I was just scribbling down a term and said maybe what we're talking about are crypto states or crypto sovereignties or something like that.
So
that could be either grounded.
But let me ask you to elaborate on that, because I don't yet understand why such a distinction is important. And maybe it's because I don't, you know, understand the key difference between the Facebook network state and the, you know, democratic network state or the decentralized network state, right? The same way that you could have a fascist nation state and a democratic nation state in terms of a 20th century construct. Why do you feel there needs to be a distinction? It strikes me that there's an opportunity to frame this as the battle for the network state.
Yeah, that could be the case too. So I'll tell you what the three of us know what the distinction is, and one of it is it's centralized control, and I would say take it or leave it terms of service versus, you know, a community consensus where you have the ability, you have alternatives if you decide not to accept the terms of service. You can say, well, I'm not going to.
Yeah, I like calling it forking off.
Yeah, exactly.
At any time you can fork off, eh?
Yeah. And I think that's an amazing thing. And when the crypto heads argue about how bad forks are, I tell them, I mean, forks, they're a blunt object in some scenarios. And if you do it too often, you really degrade your own, you undermine your own efficacy. And I said that about the Bitcoin Cash fork. Like we used to take Bitcoin Cash at EasyDNS and then it forked again. And the guys are asking me, well, which fork are we going to follow? And I said, fuck it, just dump it. It's easier to just get rid of it. And we just replaced it with Litecoin instead. And now one of those forks is forking again. And now it's just a joke. Like it's a fork bomb now. Like they just fork bombed themselves into irrelevancy. But at the top end of it, it is powerful, right? It's powerful to be able to say we have enough of a groundswell consensus here that's not cool with this set, you know, end user rules of engagement, and we're gonna just fork off a copy. I think that's very powerful. That's an option we don't have in the real in the legacy world. You can't say, I don't agree to this, so I'm gonna, you know, take a copy of everything and go. That's not an option to us, and that's one of the problems that's going on. That's why everything is so contentious and polarized. But to your point, maybe you're right, maybe it's, you know, maybe it is the battle for the network state. I just was thinking, you know, talking about it. In if one term gets the connotations that sort of override all other connotations over time, we shall see.
Well, let me just bust in here real quick and say, I think the analogy is not so much fascism versus democracy, at least in my view. And it's more like the difference I would like to try to describe is the difference between an empire that's secular and political, monopoly of on force, et cetera, say the Roman Empire, and the Catholic Church, which replaced it as the organizing institution of Europe, right? And that was a completely different structure in many ways. It did not have, it sort of shared some kinds of secular power, but it was not an empire in the same political definition. And so I would say that the network state that I would like to envision has nothing to do with Facebook or a corporate structure, which is, as Mark said, and hierarchical. And it's, as you've said, Jesse, it's black box. The entire structure is black box. The organization, the decision-making, who gets ejected or destroyed, you know, and who's favored, all that stuff is literally like, you know, more like a church, frankly. It's more like a cult. And what the difference is, an open model is more like capitalism in 1500s versus like the Catholic Church. Facebook's right. Like the church, the cult, and then capitalism, which wants to bust out of all those constraints, is like the what we're talking about.
You're evoking Eric Raymond's classic essay, The Cathedral and the Bazaar, which he wrote in the 90s as a way of describing the competing digital cultures that existed at the time. And that's why I think both qualify as the network state. And I think that, you know,
I think that crappy internet he was warning us about just kicked in.
Yeah, well, I think he'll have to reboot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, the Cathedral and the Bazaar, I can't remember how long it's been since I've read that. It's got to be like over 15 years. I think it came out in the 90s, like he was saying.
That they will both be in opposition, but yet they will also be cooperating. Right? And that's where I think that there's a certain paradox, both to the way in which the nation state and the network state are currently coexisting, but also the way in which the oppositional forces are feeding off each other in a way that, you know, I don't think, for example, that the crypto communities as we know it would be possible without social media platforms, right? And that social media platforms have allowed for all these alternate narratives to emerge. When if we were still in the old school world of broadcast, Wall Street would have crushed it. They would have prevented it from happening, and the BBS world would not have been enough to give crypto its mass. So I think that there is again, the same way that the 20th century had capitalism and communism, or, you know, capitalism and fascism. I think that there's a similar codependence or symbiotic relationship between the corporate network state and its opponents. Because look, another thing that just dawned upon me, let us not forget that even though the corporate network state is a black box, it's built on open source, right? Where would Google and Facebook and Amazon be without the open source stacks, without open source libraries, right? Their entire business model is based on the backs of open source developers. So that's why I, on the one hand, always retain a certain amount of optimism for the future, that the infrastructure for the alternate world is there. We just need to wrestle with the dominant powers, which are the corporations, which are the Facebook and the digital platforms. So, you know, that's where I agree with you guys that it's important to distinguish between the two. And I agree with you that maybe we should come up with better terminology and a better taxonomy to articulate the difference between the two. But maybe the paradox is that they are manifestations of the same thing. and that they are two different examples of what network states can be. And rather than have the privilege of choosing them, we're going to get both, whether we want them or not. Because you know the crits, we don't want the decentralized version. And we in the decentralized camp, we don't want the corporate version. But just like Cain and Abel, here we are. We got us both. And I think we're going to have to wrap our heads around how that coexistence or how that battle is going to play out. Because I'm not sure it's a choice of either or. I really think it's a situation of we're both going to find ourselves at the same party.
Can I jump in here, Charles?
Please. Because
Jesse, you led me right into something that I've been wanting to mention here for a few episodes now. You dropped out in the middle of that for about 30 seconds, but I think we captured the gist of it when you came back and you were talking about the tensions between these opposites and how it's not going to be one or the other. You get a bit of both, or you get one degree or another of both. There's a really interesting book that was written about the human brain, actually, by a guy named Ian McGilchrist called The Master and the Emissary. And you hear lots of psychologists and pop psychologists talk about the left brain, right brain, and are you left brain dominated or right brain dominated? And he wrote a whole different take on it called The Master and the Emissary. And the gist of it is, you really have nothing without both, right? He didn't say it in his book, but I sort of took that analogy and thought, I feel that same interdependency is present in all dialectical opposites. So conservatism and liberalism, centralization, decentralization, all of this stuff, you can't have a functioning society with one or the other just because you're never going to get a uniformity of consensus. You're always going to have people who prioritize things differently. So some are going to prioritize this and other people are going to prioritize this. And how do you get that tension? And so at different times in history, when you get that pendulum kind of dynamic, maybe you have tension between centralization and decentralization. So at some points in history, one is the master and the other is the emissary. And then over time, it kind of reverses. And normally, take conservatism and liberalism, you have that tension going back and forth. I think part of that breakdown that's happened over the last 4 to 10 years, call it, is instead of those two existing as an interdependent polarity that functions as a whole, it's at the risk of breaking down so that either side sort of abrogates the legitimacy of the other side completely. So it's like, we don't need the master, or we don't need the emissary, I just want to be the master, and both sides are saying that. And that's kind of where this perception of breakdown is. But overall, we need them both, and at different points in the cycle, one will be the master, the other will be the emissary, and it will adjust, hopefully.
So if I could quickly both agree with you and push back simultaneously, I think you're absolutely right. I think that that is the appropriate analogy or metaphor to use. But as, you know, a reluctant Canuckistani, or as someone who finds himself Canadian, allow me to put forward the provocative counter argument that there really is no such thing as an American conservative. That an American conservative is actually a right-wing American liberal. And that what you have in the United States are two kinds of liberals who are in such different tribes that they have to oppose each other in everything, right? If one picks red, the other has to pick blue. If one picks X, the other has to pick Y. But to your point, because they are literally kind of two essences of the same thing, they're constantly flipping back and forth, and they need each other. Their identity depends upon the opposition to the other guy. Without the other guy, who are they, right? And, you know, that's part of the brilliance of the American dream, that otherwise oppositional elements are actually the same thing, in that they both believe in America, they both believe in patriotism, they both believe in capitalism. You know, like they fundamentally are individualist liberals, in the sense that a true conservative believes in the community over the individual. And, you know, and that's where there are some American conservatives. They tend to be Christians, and
I find it funny that you say that, although you can't hear me saying that I find it funny because your network dropped out again. Because I feel like I just want to flip everything he just said to the other side. That it's like, it's not the conservatives that say the community matters more. It's the left liberals that say individuals don't matter as much. It's the greater good that counts and all that counts. But he's not even going to be able to hear me say that. And he would probably push back more than gently on it.
Well, let me, in his absence, let me take this back to...
He's back.
Again. And is Jesse back? I see his eyebrows moving.
Continue. I would take that as a sign from the gods that what I had to say was not important. So please.
Well, I want to take the conversation of the network state again back in another direction. Not that this polarity and this what you guys are describing is sort of you could say it's two sides of the brain, which is actually a three layered thing, right? Like, you know, the reptilian, you know, and so on. But, you know, so we can kind of go there, or we can go to a sort of ontological thing where identity is yin and yang, right? Your identity is formed by your opposite, et cetera, et cetera. But I want to go back to what I think is important here, I'm sorry, which is capital and agency are the core functions of any human group. Who controls capital, who's got the capital, who has access to capital, who can hope for capital and who can't, who has agency, who can hope for agency, etc. Now, in the global state of the economy, and it has extremes at various places, but it's true of virtually every economy, is at incredible extremes of imbalance and destabilization. A handful of people globally control virtually all of the capital, at least the productive capital, and most of the agency. And actually, in other words, the power, the control of their own lives, the setting aside of options, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's going to have to swing back, all right? It's going to swing back in any number of ways. It can be controlled. It can be uncontrolled. It can be a mix of predictable and unpredictable, you know, static plus, you know, nonlinear. History has plenty of examples, right? But it's going to swing back. And so the whole, for me, the network state is the corporate network state. If it inhibits this swing or is part of the resistance to that and in its attempt to control and centralize all the agency and wealth, the productive capital, it will be destroyed because it's running against history. If it morphs into something that actually enables people to acquire capital and agency, then it's going to be one of the winning, you know, network states out there. So that's kind of my sense is, I don't think people grasp, this is my sense as a doom and gloomer. And just today I said, I'm not really a doom and gloomer. I am a cycles system guy, person. That's what I care about. That's what I look at. And that's why I'm doom and gloom, is the cycles and systems are going in one direction. And so, to some degree, if we don't admit that or look at that, we're just talking about superficialities, because the pendulum is going to swing, and there's plenty of history of that. So that's what I think. And so the decentralized network state we talk about is clearly a mechanism to redistribute capital, share capital, and share and distribute agency. So it's obviously in the win column. Now, everything else, I don't know. Nation state, corporate network state, I don't know. If they're going to be on the resistance fighting history, they're going to be destroyed.
Well, and that's where, while agreeing with you, you did sort of contradict yourself there, Charles, because if you're a systems, what was it, systems and
cycles.
If you're a systems and cycles guy, you don't need to be doom and gloom. You just have to look past the doom and gloom part of the cycle and focus on what comes after that and put all that in there as motivation for us to get through the doom and gloom or to skip it.
Oh, no, I totally agree with you. And in fact, I think that's really what what we're all trying to do is, I mean, maybe I get bogged down in the doom and gloom, the bottom part of that cycle, but actually in my mind, my work is all about the next iteration out of this. You know,
but when we're thinking a little selfishly, when we look at this at the huge secular scales, if the doom and gloom trough of the cycle is going to last several lifetimes, it can't help but to be a little deflating to go, okay, so the rest of our natural lives and our children's natural lives and possibly their children will be in the trough of the doom and gloom part, and then they're going to come out of it. And then that brings us back. Remember the lost first episode, the Foundation Project? If we can reduce the trough of the cycle to the... Your sound is practically all gone, by the way.
Maybe that's...
Now you're back.
Okay, that's the internet. I was just saying, if you are going to take such an interpretation of said cycle being that long, then yes, I would understand why you would be overcome by depression. Mm-hmm. I might suggest that such an interpretation is, while obviously plausible, not in your self-interest to take, right? Like, if you're going to talk about self-interest, then your self-interest would be to take the most optimistic interpretation possible. So at least as Rome burns, you enjoy the barbecue.
That's an excellent, excellent point, because I've actually said many times privately, and it's no secret. I've never made a secret of this, but I am in recovery. I've been for 22 years clean and sober. And one of the things I talk about in that place is one of the jobs of recovery is you have to brainwash yourself into being an optimist. And whether you're a pessimist in life or an optimist in life, you're brainwashing yourself to be one or the other. So if you can, you might as well choose one or the other. And it's more productive to choose. So you're either brainwashing yourself to be miserable or you're brainwashing yourself to be optimistic. And it's just a better, Pascal's wager to choose to brainwash yourself to be optimistic and say, okay, the dark age will last maybe 5 years or 10 and then we'll come out of it. And
not to be the linguist in the room, but if you're choosing it, is it still brainwashing?
Well, in a sense, because, you know, I've even been, like I said, over the last several weeks, I sort of moved out of a different phase and I've changed the way I'm consuming news and I changed the way I'm interacting with social media. And I'm like, well, that's kind of a form of continuing to program myself, brainwash myself. But I've decided, okay, I'll just brainwash myself in a more productive way.
But this is where, again, I'm pointing out you're a little too loose with those words there, friend. Mm. Programming, I think, is an appropriate phrase. Brainwashing, no, you're not doing that.
Okay. Well, you're always, I know you're very...
You're using, which is Charles's point, right? That we want to be fostering agency and participation. And you're participating in your neuroprogramming. You're, you know, being conscious about your neuro... Like, you're modeling it. I think by calling it brainwashing, you're not only undermining your own agency, but you're discouraging other people from doing it as well. Mm. When in fact, it's the opposite. We should be encouraging people to hack their own mind, because hack or be hacked, right? Either you hack it or someone else is going to hack it. So you should have such a, you know, forward-looking approach to one knowledge.
I vote for that being the program title, Hack or Be Hacked. I think there's a lot there to unpack. Go ahead.
I like that.
Well, I was going to say, because let's briefly talk about FireEye then, right? Which the other big news of the week, in which FireEye, which is this high-end cybersecurity firm who specializes in helping governments and corporations audit how they've been hacked, they were hacked. Ostensibly by the Russian government, but obviously we don't know.
Are they saying Russia? They said a state actor, but I don't know if they said, like, did they say Russia? Possibly Russia?
Yes.
Probably Russia? Okay.
Yes. Yes. So, there have been a number of other cybersecurity firms who have entered their own investigation into this. And it was an active persistent, like an APT, active persistent threat group, which is identified with the GRU in Russia, the military intelligence.
You know, I always bristle and roll my eyes when they say Russia every single time.
Yeah, that's why I'm saying it, because I know the two of you guys, that's a sore point. So I'm putting it out there that could cause this story to be suspicious. But the point is, this company had a vault of secrets. That vault is not so safe. Those secrets are not secrets no more.
And they stole their red team tools.
Yes. And so it speaks to the not just the precarity of this type of knowledge in terms of how easily it can go into the wrong hands, but to how we got to this subject, hack or be hacked.
I tell you, those episodes, as a CEO of a tech company, they keep me awake at night. And a few years ago, less high profile, but a vendor that we used called Staminus for DDoS mitigation got just opened right up, and it was bad. And I remember calling an impromptu meeting with the team, like the systems and dev team, and I said, I don't, you know, whatever it takes, this is not happening here. I want to just put all projects on hold, and I want to do a complete sweep of everything for no reason other than I don't want that to happen to us. But it's still like, yeah, it scares me. It really does, because a company that's that well funded and supposedly the top of the pyramid in terms of state of the art and countermeasures and stuff.
Well, okay, I'm going to just leap off the edge of the cliff here with a couple of crazy asides. One is, we can go back to the old Cold War strategy of the Soviet submarine force, which was called one of their techniques was a Crazy Ivan, where they knew the U.S. had superior, you know, audio technology to follow them, and they couldn't detect the following U.S. subs. So they'd have the strategy of sort of semi-randomly just like accelerating and going left and right and try to throw the person off or the sub behind them, or flip around where they could detect them. And so that may be the future of all tech firms, is you got to do a Crazy Ivan. You got to shut down, completely air gap, and redo everything just randomly. That's one crazy thought. Another crazy thought is talking about, you know, Jesse's point of how fragile this whole digital world is. I recently read this Walter Isaacson's biography of Leonardo da Vinci, you know, and he's written a number of bios, right? He wrote Steve Jobs. Well, one of his little asides in this like immense book was, he said, you know, when Steve Jobs and I sat down to unearth or rebuild, you know, everything that happened to him in the 90s, we had a very difficult time recovering even a tiny percentage of his emails. Where Leonardo, we still have 6,700 pages of his little notebooks. Now, we've lost at least 60% of that. That's maybe a third, maybe 25% survive. And so after 500 years, there's more of Leonardo's notebooks, despite all the vagaries of history and you know, wars and fires and bombings, and than there is of Steve Jobs' emails from the 1990s. That's pretty sober.
You know what I would...
You know, can I just push back there and say, who cares about Steve Jobs? He's no Leonardo da Vinci. Like, you know, whoever that is of our era, I assume we will have a lot of their ideas and notes and whatever. Steve Jobs is just a schmuck.
I think it was mostly just the difference between digital and paper.
I agree. But, that's a valid point.
You know what I will, Steve Jobs... I mean, when I read his biography, I was like, oh my God, he was kind of a prick. But you have to concede, he did make a dent in the universe. And for better or for worse, he did change the world. And he was a visionary in that respect. But what Charles's story made me think is, I would kill, and I've looked for this and I haven't found it, but I would love to have a decent archive of Usenet. Because I'll bet you there is all kinds. There's only little fragments, like little collections here and there. There would be such a trove of hot takes from the past in there that you could dig out. And, look at what Justin Trudeau said in 1992 on, you know, I'll pave the earth, right?
I hear you. Like, there's a part of me that's curious for that. There's a part of me that's grateful that it doesn't exist. It would just be used to train some machine learning model, which would just be the most toxic thing on the planet.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, so, Google had it for a while. I mean,
you make a valid point.
Sorry?
Yeah. Let me bust in here again with another concept about how long the Dark Age will last. And I think two elements occur to me. One is, you know, Toffler's book from 1970, Future Shock, right? Which has been updated by several different writers, that the acceleration is accelerated far beyond 1970, right? So if we look at that, we can say, well, the compression that took 500 years is now was 50 years, 50 years ago. Now it's 5 years because the compression rate of change is just so intense. And the other thing is, you know, we're still running on oil, folks. And that's not going to change. And so if there's any disruption, oil is 97%, you know, the fossil fuels are 97% of all energy consumed on planet Earth. All the alternatives and all that stuff is like 3%. So we're living on, talk about precarious, we're living on a precarious edge of this super high consumption, just wasteful, incredible amounts of energy consumed just to kind of keep this consumerist society afloat. That's really fragile and much more than people have any awareness of. And so, you know, that whole situation could change very rapidly too. And then so therefore there's two possible, you know, sort of vectors or dynamics that could drive some sort of like crisis that could kind of force a clean sweep and a reboot or whatever you want to call it, you know, in say 5 years. Yeah.
When I succeed in programming myself to be optimistic, my thinking on around the energy question, I think think back to Max Kaiser's remark about oil when he said we will never hit 90 million barrels a day in consumption again. It's over. Now, he's highly optimistic about solar energy, and maybe he's right. My cousins are very optimistic about solar energy. They follow a guy named Tony Seba, who just thinks it's going to be a radical shift. In Tony Seba's presentation, he does that thing where he shows this intersection on the corner of New York City, like 1900 or something, and there's all horses, and he says, there's one car in this picture. Right, find the car in this picture. Then he puts up another picture. He says, this is the same corner 20 years later. There's one horse in this picture. Find the horse, right? It switched from horse to car in under a generation, blindingly fast. And he says that we're going to make the same sort of blinding switch to solar energy once we get some efficiencies down and stuff like that. I don't know about that. I think we're going to go nuclear. I think there's thorium that's sitting there right in front of our eyes that's practically a magic bullet that when the necessity forces itself onto the scene, it will be looked at seriously. And he might be right that for these reasons, we will never consume 90 million barrels of oil a day again. And that was peak oil. It just kind of came and went in a different measurement than we traditionally think of peak oil in the past. So we might engineer our way out of the energy thing. That's optimistic, isn't it?
Uh-oh. Hell freezing over? Marks? Optimistic? No, I think you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, where all three of us are not part of the continental United States, I think all three of us are still subject to the biases and narratives that come out of the continental United States, because tragically, all three of us spend way too much time and energy consuming media from the continental United States. I just spent the last 3 days attending and participating in the International Forum of Agricultural Robotics, hosted out of Toulouse, France, which turns out is a hotbed of agricultural robotic activity and development. And I loved it. I really had a great time. This is a fantastic event. I learned quite a bit, in part because it reminded me that there's a world outside of America. And obviously, as a Canadian, I should know this, but due to the nature of our media consumption, as I mentioned, it's easy to forget. And oh boy, is there another world going on over there in Europe. And what was interesting at this event was the contrast between the American representatives who were there in terms of their agricultural robotics and their vision of what the future of farming would be, and the Europeans. Now, I absolutely lament that the Chinese industry was not present at all, and obviously because they are a huge force in robotics, especially robotics and agriculture. But the Europeans, and the French in particular, were really on side with our vision of the network state, in the sense that they imagined robotics as being a path towards sustainability, a path away from pesticides, a path away from concentrated land ownership. And, you know, there are a number of open source agricultural robotic initiatives which are really designed for micro farmers around the world. And this is open hardware, open software, and it's a resiliating vision, right? It's a way of thinking, wow, we could really use technology to not only upend the food supply, but to transform the production of food supply away from what is basically big chemical and away from the sort of big ag to a much more distributed, a much more responsive, and how more foundational can you get than agriculture and food? So this was a reminder that we, and I mean all three of us, but I also mean most of the folks who watch us, need to remember that there's a world outside of America, and that there are ideas in this world that are really contributing to a viable, decentralized cyberpunk utopia, for lack of a better word, and that they're using technology to not only facilitate decentralization, but facilitate the distribution of knowledge, in many cases, revolutionary knowledge when it comes to sustainability. Because going back to Charles's point, the robots that were coming out of Europe were either electric or solar powered, right? Or not even needing much power at all, in the sense that they're not designed to be fully autonomous, but they're designed to work with human beings. So they might still be pushed, but have like basic low power AI to do machine visioning in terms of where to like kill weeds with like a blade rather than a chemical, compared to the American technologies, which is just a tractor but with no driver. So still diesel powered, still huge, still designed to, you know, work thousands of acres instead of tens of acres, versus the opportunity here is not to create the tractor to a robot. It's to create new robots that are tiny, that are small, that could be in swarms, that could, you know, be so accessible and affordable that a small farmer could afford them, if not use it for free. That speaks to different visions of the future, different visions of how technology can be used. And it was refreshing for me as a Canadian to be reminded that there's a world beyond America, and all those French guys across the pond, they really do have some wild ideas about open source and co-ops and ways to use technology as a means and not as an end.
Yeah, that's great. I'm so happy you brought that in, brought that into the discussion here as not only an optimistic thing, but also for me, as an avenue for me to talk about one of my favorite subjects, which is called appropriate technology, which is getting more with less. Mark? Are you, Mark, did you say something?
I can hear you, Charles.
Oh, all right.
Maybe we're losing Mark somehow.
Yeah. Mark, can you hear us? Mark?
I lost you for a minute, but I think if you kept talking, I think we captured it. So,
oh,
like
okay.
I lost the sound, well, but I think the recording still got you.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, anyways, appropriate technology is what I think is exciting and what I kind of embedded in the CLIMB system, which is doing more with less. Like, we're so used to technology requiring more resources and energy and all that. And the ideas you're talking about, which I find really exciting, is they're using tremendously less resources. and being cheap, then they're accessible to much more of the planet than a lot of the techno whiz kind of technology, you know. And so I find that really heartening. And I'll give a quick example of a system that would work with that kind of ag robotics on a small scale you're talking about, which is using solar panels on a DC system. So you don't waste 2/3 of the power in the inverter to get it to AC. You know, I mean, just really simple, basic things like that have huge consequences on the ground when for somebody that doesn't have a lot of capital, but they have a cheap cell phone that they can get information on. And if this decentralized network, people can make money, you know, selling and distributing these small, cheap robots, then that really is a revolution. And that really is positive.
That could be the nature of the revolution that everyone is sort of anticipating, but not quite. Like, a lot of people are calling for like an environmental, ecological revolution that's actually would require everyone involved to ratchet down their energy consumption and standard of living, and that's a hard sell, and people are going to push back on that. But if what is happening instead, and this has kind of been the nature of technological revolutions throughout history, something, a different angle comes out where suddenly what the revolution that could be coming down the pipe is an efficiency revolution, where suddenly you're getting all of this extra output with a lot less input of energy. It's suddenly democratizing a lot of this accessibility to this technology and the ability to distribute it. And going back to something Charles said earlier on that I wanted to just slightly challenge was that we're not going to redistribute the capital. We're going to reclaim the capital away from the handful of people at the top. And it's basically, Thomas Sowell points out that a lot of times that a government idea to change something that's fundamentally wrong was already being changed by the underlying dynamics in that were in play already. But I might be wrong. I mean, Thomas Sowell does say that, but I think I'm thinking specifically of Amory Lovins now by mistake, who said, you know, people were worried that the whales were going to go extinct because they wanted the whale oil, and then kerosene came along and suddenly it became moot. And so that's what I'm trying to clumsily articulate right now, that this kind of like micro robot, micro powered, solar powered can unlock all kinds of efficiencies that do ratchet down energy consumption without everyone having to sort of go back to living in the 17th century kind of a lifestyle. And that could actually...
I feel you're making a very important point, and you're framing a lot of the environmental debate the way it's been framed, but it's obviously not that simplistic. And you alluded to it in the sense that, you know, we would have already achieved, I think as a technology researcher, if I look back, not just in my lifetime, but going to your point about the horse and the car and how quickly that transformation happened, that the 20th century alone, the technology revolutions that occurred were so profound that they should have resulted in the kind of Star Trek or futurist society that science fiction wrote about. But the nature of capitalism meant that all that wealth went into such few hands that that revolution didn't happen. And I think moving forward, that's exactly what could happen once again, that the revolution in robotics, the revolution in cryptocurrency, the revolution in all that stuff could just make Mark Zuckerberg richer, could just make Elon Musk richer, could just make Jeff Bezos richer. And that's where, you know, on the one hand, to Charles's point, there needs to be greater agency. People need to feel as if not only can they demand a different future, but they have the power within their hands to make it so. That is where I nod my head to the cryptocurrency people. And Mark, you sort of changed my perspective on this when you made the argument of, well, they did it, right? Like, Bitcoin may be imperfect, but they accomplished something with that in and of itself. And so I will tip my hat to the crypto world that they still believe that they can achieve the future they desire, when most other people, including many of the people here currently right now, don't think that they can achieve the future they desire. So I think the more people who believe that they can achieve the future they desire, the less likely it can be stolen from them. The less likely it can be extracted, the less likely it can be co-opted, the less likely it can be appropriated. And that's why I feel part of the role of open source, part of the role of cryptocurrency, part of the role of decentralized whatever, is role modeling. It's just going, hey, look, we can do it. And hey, look, I'm doing it right now. I'm walking and chewing bubblegum at the same time. Right? That, I think, is so powerful because the internet allows us to amplify these micro narratives into meta narratives that start giving shape to this network state or this decentralized democratic society or however you want to think about it. You know, which is where, in wrapping the podcast, I usually say, because that's why we do what we do, because we're trying to think about these things and talk about these things. But I also, that's why I love this agricultural forum, because now I've learned about these French open source agroecology projects, and I'm going to start bringing them to my community. And I'm going to start writing about it. And I'm going to start spreading the word, because the more people who learn about it, the more like, hey, yeah, our food doesn't have to be for profit. That people should be remunerated for their food. Yes, people should make a good living as a farmer. But food should be accessible. And the production of food should be accessible. So that if anyone wanted to make food, they could make food. And so if anyone wanted to eat, they could eat. Like, that's such a basic idea. That if food was decentralized, if the production of food was decentralized, that you could choose to go whoever you wanted for your food. I mean, now we're getting utopian. But that is, I feel, within our grasp. That it's so close. That it's the kind of world we can have so easily. It's really just a matter of the will to wish it into being. And again, that's why I am a little bit of an optimist, even though I do agree with you guys that there's some darkness ahead. Although, for lack of a better word, let's just call it winter and hope it only lasts 3 months.
Well, my final comment is, Mark, I really like your phrase, which I think includes everything Jesse just summarized, which I think was an excellent summary of what we're talking about. Reclaiming capital and agency. That's a pretty good term, you know, for it. It's not wresting it away or redistributing it. It's creating a whole new source. So reclaiming capital and agency is a pretty good term. And that, I think, summarizes what Jesse's been describing about ag robots. So anyways, that's my parting comment.
It's a good place to wrap it up. The only thing I would gently push back on everything Jesse said was that it's not capitalism that leeches the dreams away from the people. It's the political system. But that's an age-old debate. Right? Is it corporations capture the government, or is it the government mutates the corporations, and we will never end it in our lifetimes?
I would even afford you, if you wanted, because, you know, really what we're doing here is bookmarking future discussions. Yeah. I would even afford, if you wanted, that we've seen a certain kind of capitalism, and that there are opportunities for different kinds of capitalism that, for example, are not monopoly capitalism or surveillance capitalism.
Yes.
And that's part of what we've seen in the last several decades, if not part of the 20th century.
Yeah, I mean, my original blog back before Out of the Cave was rebootingcapitalism.com. You know, it's just like, let's just, okay. Anyway, I think that's a good place to wrap for today. So like us on YouTube, Spotify, Stitcher, and check us out at accessofeasy.com, and we'll see you all next week. 死